What was it we were supposed to want to work for? For the love of our brothers? What brothers? For the bums, the loafers, the moochers we saw all around us? And whether they were cheating or plain incompetent, whether they were unwilling or unable, what difference did that make to us? If we were tied for life to the level of their unfitness, faked or real, how long could we care to go on? We had no way of knowing their ability. We had no way of controlling their needs. All we knew was that we were beasts of burden, struggling blindly in some sort of place that was half hospital, half stockyards, a place geared to nothing but disability, disaster, disease. Beasts put there for the relief of whatever, whoever chose to say was whichever's need. Love of our brothers? That's when we learned to hate our brothers for the first time in our lives. We began to hate them for every meal they swallowed, for every pleasure they enjoyed, for one man's new shirt, for another wife's hat, for an outing with their family, for a paint job on their house. It was taken from us. It was paid for by our privations, our denials, our hunger. We began to spy on one another, each hoping to catch the others lying about their needs so as to cut their allowance at the next meeting. We began to have stool pigeons who informed on people, who reported that somebody had bootlegged a turkey to his family on some Sunday, which he'd paid for by gambling, most likely. We began to meddle into one another's lives. We provoked family quarrels to get somebody's relatives thrown out. Any time we saw a man starting to go steady with a girl, we made life miserable for him. We broke up many engagements. We didn't want anyone to marry. We didn't want any more dependents to feed. In the old days, we used to celebrate if somebody had a baby. We used to chip in and help him out with the hospital bills if he happened to be hard-pressed for the moment. Now, if a baby was born, we didn't speak to the parents for weeks. Babies, to us, had become what locusts were to farmers. In the old days, we used to help a man if he had a bad illness in the family. Now, well, I'll tell you about just one case. It was a mother of a man who had been with us for 15 years. She was a kindly old lady, cheerful and wise. She knew us all by our first names, and we all liked her. We used to like her. One day she slipped on the cellar stairs and fell and broke her hip. We knew what that meant at her age. The staff doctor said that she'd have to be sent to a hospital in town for expensive treatments that would take a long time. The old lady died the night before she was to leave for town. They never established the cause of death. No, I don't know whether she was murdered. Nobody said that. Nobody would talk about it at all. All I know is that I... And that's what I can't forget. I, too, had caught myself wishing that she would die. This, may God forgive us, was the brotherhood, the security, the abundance that the plan was supposed to achieve for us. Was there any reason why this sort of horror would ever be preached by anybody? Was there anybody who got any profit from it? There was. The Starnes heirs. I hope you're not going to remind me that they'd sacrificed a fortune and turned the factory over to us as a gift. We were fooled by that one, too. Yes, they gave up the factory. But profit, ma'am, depends on what it is you're after. And what the Starnes heirs were after, no money on earth could buy. Money is too clean and innocent for that. Eric Starnes, the youngest. He was a jellyfish that didn't have the guts to be after anything in particular. He got himself voted as director of our public relations department, which didn't do anything, except that he had a staff for the not doing of anything, so we didn't have to bother sticking around the office. The pay he got, well, I shouldn't call it pay. None of us was paid. The alms we voted to him was fairly modest, about 10 times what I got, but that wasn't riches. Eric didn't care for money. He wouldn't have known what to do with it. He spent his time hanging around among us, showing how chummy he was and democratic. He wanted to be loved, it seems. The way he went about it was to keep reminding us that he had given us the factory. We couldn't stand him. Gerald Starnes was our director of production. We never learned just what the size of his rake-off, his alms, had been. It would have taken a staff of accountants to figure that out, and a staff of engineers to trace the way it was piped, directly or indirectly, into his office. None of it was supposed to be for him. It was all for company expenses. Gerald had 3 cars, 4 secretaries, 5 telephones, and he used to throw champagne and caviar parties that no tax-paying tycoon in the country could have afforded. He spent more money in 1 year than his father had earned in profits in the last 2 years of his life. We saw a 100-pound stack, 100 pounds, we weighed them, of magazines in Gerald's office, full of stories about our factory and our noble plan, with big pictures of Gerald Starnes calling him a great social crusader. Gerald liked to come into the shops at night dressed in his formal clothes, flashing diamond cufflinks the size of a nickel and shaking cigar ashes all over. Any cheap show-off who's got nothing to parade but his cash is bad enough. Except that he makes no bones about the cash being his, and you're free to gape at him or not, as you wish. And mostly you don't. But when a bastard like Gerald Starnes puts on an act and keeps spouting that he doesn't care for material wealth, that he's only serving the family, that all the lushness is not for himself but for our sake and for the common good, because it's necessary to keep up the prestige of the company and of the noble plan in the eyes of the public, then that's when you learn to hate the creatures you've never hated anything human. But his sister Ivy was worse. She really did not care for material wealth. The alms she got was no bigger than ours, and she went about in scuffed, flat-heeled shoes and shirtwaists, just to show how selfless she was. She was our director of distribution. She was a lady in charge of our needs. She was one who held us by the throat. Of course, distribution was supposed to be decided by voting, by the voice of the people. But when the people are 6,000 howling voices trying to decide without yardstick, rhyme, or reason, when there are no rules to the game and each can demand anything but has a right to nothing, when everybody holds power over everybody's life except his own, then it turns out, as it did, that the voice of the people is Ivy Starnes. By the end of the second year, we dropped the pretense of the family meetings in the name of production efficiency and time economy. One meeting used to take 10 days, and all the petitions of need were simply sent to Miss Starnes's office. No, not sent. They had to be recited to her in person by every petitioner. Then she made up a distribution list, which she read to us for our vote of approval at a meeting that lasted 3/4 of an hour. We voted approval. There was a 10-minute period on the agenda for discussion and objections. We made no objections. We knew better by that time. Nobody can divide a factory's income among thousands of people without some sort of a gauge to measure people's value. Her gauge was bootlicking. Selfless. In her father's time, all of his money wouldn't have given him a chance to speak to his lousiest wiper and get away with it as she spoke to our best skilled workers and their wives. She had pale eyes that looked fishy, cold, and dead. And if you ever wanted to see pure evil, you should have seen the way her eyes glinted when she watched some man who'd talked back to her once and who'd just heard his name on the list of those getting nothing above basic pittance. And when you saw it, you saw the real motive of any person who's ever preached the slogan, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. This was the whole secret of it. At first I kept wondering how it could be possible that the educated, the cultured, the famous men of the world could make a mistake of this size and preach as righteousness this sort of abomination, when 5 minutes of thought should have told them what would happen if somebody tried to practice what they preached. Now I know that they didn't do it by any kind of mistake. Mistakes of this size are never made innocently. If men fall for some vicious piece of insanity when they have no way to make it work and no possible reason to explain their choice, it's because they have a reason that they do not wish to tell. And we weren't so innocent either when we voted for that plan at the first meeting. We didn't do it just because we believed that the drippy old guff they spewed was good. We had another reason. But the guff helped us to hide it from our neighbors and from ourselves. The guff gave us a chance to pass off as virtue something that we'd be ashamed to admit otherwise. There wasn't a man voting for it who didn't think that under a setup of this kind, he'd muscle in on the profits of the men abler than himself. There wasn't a man rich and smart enough, but that he didn't think that somebody was richer and smarter, and this plan would give him a share of his betters' wealth and brain. But while he was thinking that he'd get unearned benefits from the men above, he forgot about the men below, who'd get unearned benefits too. He forgot about all his inferiors, who'd rush to drain him, just as he hoped to drain his superiors. The worker who liked the idea that his need enlisted him to a limousine like his boss's forgot that every bum and beggar on earth would come howling that their need entitled them to an icebox like his own. That was our real motive when we voted. That was the truth of it. But we didn't like to think it. So the less we liked it, the louder we yelled about our love for the common good. Well, we got what we asked for. By the time we saw what it was that we'd asked for, it was too late. We were trapped with no place to go. The best men among us left the factory in the first week of the plan. We lost our best engineers, superintendents, foremen, and highest skilled workers. A man of self-respect doesn't turn into a milch cow for anybody. Some able fellows tried to stick it out, but they couldn't take it for long. We kept losing our men, and they kept escaping from the factory like from a pest hole, till we had nothing left except the men of need, but none of the men of ability.